The last leg of my sabbatical journey at the end of last March was an overnight stop in Rochester, New York. In the fall of 1967, I entered theological school in Rochester and graduated from there 4 years later and began my career in ministry. The seminary I attended has a rather pastoral location. It sits on top of a hill looking south towards the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York, and after finding myself a place to stay that night, I drove up to the campus. For late March in Rochester, the weather was surprisingly mild, and I sat on this long patio that runs the length in front of the school and looked out over what had been very familiar scenery to me in the late 1960s. Thought about some of the term papers, some of the exams I had sweated out while looking at that same scene sometime earlier. And I don't know where it came from, not that it matters, I guess, but from somewhere I heard a question being put to me as I sat there. Okay, so what do you got to say for yourself some 35 years later? That was a little unsettling. Just who or what is demanding that I make some account of my life? Or maybe these kinds of things just happen when you reach a certain age. But the experience did provide me an opportunity to do some personal reflection and meditation on the changes I'd experienced in my own life and those I'd witnessed in the world around me. But the content of those reflections is not where I'm going today. For what also came to mind in that moment were some words a gentleman I had lunch with a few days earlier had written in a book of his that he autographed for me. The man's name is Dennis McNally. He has written what I consider to be the best biography on Jack Kerouac that's out there. In addition to sharing this common interest, our other point of commonality is that his now deceased father was a Unitarian Universalist minister and served the UU Church in Haverhill, Massachusetts for a number of years. Well, after writing his Kerouac biography, during much of the 1980s and into some of the 90s, Mr. McNally was the publicist and the advance man for the group The Grateful Dead. And he's written a very outstanding book, this big, thick tome here, a very outstanding book about the history of that group and the place that it played in American culture. It even made the New York Times bestseller list for a few weeks. Well, after a few personal words to me in signing the book, Dennis wrote the words, "There is a road, no simple highway," and then he signed his name. The line, as you all now know, is from the song Ripple by Robert Hunter and Jerry Garcia. Just heard Jeff and Dan sing it for us and lead us in it. Well, that was the line I found myself humming as I sat on the patio, my old seminary. There is a road, no simple highway, between the dawn and the dark of night. According to Dennis's book here, Jerry Garcia once said of Ripple, "Whenever I sing that song, there's a moment when I say to myself, am I really some kind of a minister?" Given Garcia's comment, perhaps it was appropriate of me to invoke some of the words to this song in the place where I prepared for the ministry right about the time that it was being written. Well, a little bit of disclaimer time here. I am not now, nor have I ever been a deadhead. Although that was or is an okay thing to be for those who were into it. Jeff, I understand you followed Jerry around for a few years there. Yeah, all right. Really, for all of my interest in the Beat Generation era, I never quite followed through to the hippie scene somehow. I think maybe it might have been an accident or a fact of my birth. I was too old to be a beat and too young to be a hippie, so I just kind of made the best I could. And until I had read McNally's book, I don't think I could have even named for you 5 Grateful Dead songs. But I found myself quite taken with Ripple. It's full of metaphors, you probably noticed, that sometimes seem to even double back on themselves, but it's not my purpose this morning to try to meticulously dissect its words. I would imagine that like Don McLean's American Pie, there's probably been master's theses written on what this song really means. which I'm sure gives Robert Hunter a really good laugh. I will, however, pull a few of its other lines in here and there, as I want to use one that I already invoked to launch the church here. For I think what lies before us as persons of a liberal faith tradition, as members of a congregation, and as citizens of a community, nation, and world, is a road which is anything but a simple highway. In its broadest interpretation, my passage for this morning is a metaphor for the life journey itself, birth and death, the dawn and the dark of night. The road and the highway refer, I believe, to choices we are given after our personal dawn or morning has broken. We can make our own road, deliberately seeking purpose and intention and meaningful engagement with the light that is all around us. Or one can take the simple highway and cruise along in a largely unreflective manner, living in accordance with the general societal assumptions of one's day and seeking to live up to whatever standards of success, quote unquote, one's culture may dictate. And it is usually those who choose the road over the simple highway that change the course of history and even the nature of the highway itself. Rosa Parks, for example, could have chosen the simple highway when she got on the bus in Birmingham, Alabama, on that first day of December in 1955. She could have acquiesced to the general societal assumptions of her day about the proper place of persons of color. But by the very simple act of sitting in the front of a bus, she opted instead for the road. The hard road. And the road to racial justice in our nation ended up taking a decisive turn as a result. And that road, as we know, is still ongoing. To give these words yet another angle, I believe the reason people seek out religious communities is because they are looking for the road and not the simple highway. Looking for a place of meaning, hope, and human engagement, for a communion of people and ideals and values that expects and demands something of them and to which they can freely give of themselves. I believe we are called to offer and to be one such community. There are a couple of other lines from Hunter's song that I think demonstrate well the yin and the yang, or the dual truths, if you will, of how we approach the liberal religious journey here as Unitarian Universalists. One says, "The path is for your steps alone," while the other says, "Reach out your hand if your cup be empty." However, at odds with each other, these two lines may seem on first reading, we affirm both. Yes, we do believe that each person ultimately has to seek and find his or her truth, but we do not send you out on that search empty-handed or with an empty cup. Reach out your hand if you're feeling empty, confused, or questioned. For there are other hands here that will join with you on our common way. And then there's the line, "If you should stand, then who's to guide you? If I knew the way, I would take you home." These words, I believe, contain the implicit message of a covenant in which we share here. We offer our guidance to one another in our homeward journeys of the mind and spirit, however sure or unsure we may be of the way itself. And while I know that my own words do not always glow with the golden sunshine, may in fact oftentimes sound more like a tune played on the harp unstrung. I too am someone on this road, seeking my own way to whatever home may be, a fellow traveler with you, as we now enter another year of ministry together in this wonderful congregation. I want to say a little then about the road that I see calling us. Indeed, it is no simple highway. I find for myself right now, and this may be the case with you, that there is much to life that I want to feel good about, that I want to celebrate, that I want to be joyful over. And there is. And I do. And yet, right on that razor edge of that thirst for joy is some feelings of despair and frustration. The sheer human folly that is sometimes shown around us. In the Thursday, September 9th issue, the New York Times, it was 10 days ago, I don't know if you saw it, there were pictures. These pictures of some 1,000 young American men and women soldiers who have now been killed in the Iraqi war. I will readily grant as a human being and as an American citizen that there are certain values and ideals worth fighting and dying for, and that are worth defending with one's very life. But I've yet to hear any kind of coherent and rational reason given by those who sent these people to their deaths as to why their lives had to be yielded up. I also find I'm developing an increasingly disturbing fear of fear. I'll be offering a sermon on this subject a few weeks from now, so I'm not going to belabor it here, only to say that my memories of the McCarthy era in the early 1950s are extremely vague, since I was only a kid at the time. But I cannot personally recall a time in this nation when our foreign and domestic policies, to say nothing of just general political posturings, have been more fear-driven than is the case right now. I do not dispute that we live in a dangerous world. I don't dispute that we need to deal with those dangers. But I believe it is possible to effectively deal with danger without succumbing to the irrational and ugly side of fear. I'll say more on this on a Sunday in October. In looking to travel a road then where one's yes to life can still be said, even in the face of a chorus of no's, I find myself turning more to poetry than to theology these days. Back in the mid-1950s, during the year to which I just referred, Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty, who for my money at age 85 is America's premier living poet, wrote a poem I want to share. It appeared in one of his first collections of writings called A Coney Island of the Mind. It's whimsical and it's funny and it's lighthearted and it's caustically sobering all at the same time. And it's the best statement I can find about what it means to travel on that razor edge of finding joy in living while being also aware of so much that is less than joyful and life denying. Give a listen. The world is a beautiful place to be born into. If you don't mind happiness not always being so very much fun, if you don't mind a touch of hell now and then, just when everything is fine, because even in heaven, they don't sing all the time. The world is a beautiful place to be born into. If you don't mind some people dying all the time, or maybe only starving some of the time, which isn't half so bad if it isn't you. Oh, the world is a beautiful place to be born into. If you don't mind a few dead minds in the higher places, or a bomb or two now and then in your upturned faces, or other such improprieties as our name brand society is prey to, with its men of distinction and its men of extinction and its various segregations and congressional investigations and other constipations that our fool flesh is heir to. Yes. The world is the best place of all for a lot of such things as making the fun scene and making the love scene and making the sad scene and singing low songs and having inspirations and walking around looking at everything and smelling flowers and goose and statues and even thinking and kissing people and making babies and wearing pants and waving hats and dancing and going swimming in rivers on picnics in the middle of the summer and just generally living it up. Yes, but then right in the middle of it comes the smiling mortician. We are called to be joyously alive, even in the face of the various deaths that also confront us. And while that is not an easy road to take, in my mind it simply beats the simple highway. The life stance that Ferlinghetti calls for here has a parallel to Reverend Forrest Church's definition of religion. I couldn't help but notice Forrest is certainly one of the more prolific thinkers and writers within our Unitarian Universalist movement today. And one of his earlier books, he wrote his definition of religion, which I know is familiar to a number of you. He said, "Religion is our dual response to the human reality of being alive and knowing that we will die." Now, Reverend Church, knowing him as I do, would be the first to admit that his words don't quite have a poetic zing and ring to them, as do Ferlinghetti's. But he's saying as a theologian and minister what Lawrence is saying as a poet. Religion is how we find our meaning and our purpose and our hope and joy, and value, and transformation in life in the face of the transience of life, and oftentimes in the face of the tragedy and the pain that life can bring. And we hear our religious community seeking to live on that edge. I have to get in one more bit about Ferlinghetti before leaving him. I attended a reading he gave at a bookstore in Berkeley last July in the wake of the publication of his latest work called Americus. These poems deal mostly with the post-9/11 atmosphere in our land, and in the same manner as the poem I just read, some are very whimsical and fun and poignant, and also at the same time pungent and biting. He's got that eye-twinkling frivolity still about him, for which he is best known. Well, I got to speak with him briefly after his reading, but I kept it very short since I actually had an appointment with him the following day at his office at the City Lights bookstore. And it's too long of a story for me to tell now, but due to a really boneheaded blunder on my part, I got to the bookstore about an hour or so later than I was supposed to be there. So the co-manager of City Lights, a very delightful woman with whom I also had an appointment, told me when I finally arrived, Mr. Ferlinghetti had been there for a while, but he had a bit of a cold and had gone home to take care of it. He wrote me a nice little note. She said he needed to go home to take care of his cold because he wanted to feel well enough to be able to go to a San Francisco Giants baseball game that night. Well, as bad as I felt about blowing our meeting, there was something that sounded right and good to me about a man who can one night give a very beautiful, while at the same time quite caustic poetry reading about our country's state of affairs, and then go to a Major League Baseball game the next night. That is my kind of poet. Well, this is then the road that calls us now. One in which we rejoice in the goodness and the blessings of life and savor the joy of it, while also also facing down forces, principalities, and powers that would deny or diminish that goodness and joy. Whether those forces be in the world around us or within the recesses of our own hearts and souls. And as we begin another year together, this theme or idea will be the undercurrent of much of what I will have to say and live out with you. For now, I just want to hold up one more verse from Hunter and Garcia's Ripple that I think will hold us for today. I know a common affliction among many of us ministers in our gear up for the year sermon is we feel we have to say a whole year's worth of stuff in that one sermon. I'm just supposed to be setting a tone this Sunday. We'll deal with some more of the details as we go along. Anyway, the verse, a line of which I've already used, says, reach out your hand if your cup be empty. If your cup is full, may it be again. Let it be known there is a fountain that was not made by the hand of man. Mr. Hunter were writing a song today, he might say the fountain is not made by human hands, but it's the same idea. Sometimes, in weeks and months ahead, you're going to come in here with your cup empty. At other times, it will be so full that you'll come here with plenty to share with others. Still other times, it will be either half full or half empty, depending upon how you choose to view it. But whatever the state of your cup, I do believe that ultimately, we draw from a fountain not made by human hands. It is that ultimate source of all life that is both within and beyond each one of us. However we envision and name the source or the ground of all life, or the blessed and holy spirit of life about which we sing every Sunday, however we name it, we come here to partake of it in order that we may walk well on our chosen roads. The ones we walk as individuals and the ones we walk on as part of this covenanted religious community. We Unitarian Universalists, I think, sometimes spend more time than we need to contending over what the right and proper name of this fountain should be. Sometimes to the point that we never actually get around to drinking from it. But I think we have a deep and rich fountain here. Refresh and nurture each of us on our life journeys. I hope we can each and all partake from it well. As for its precise name, well, once again, I'm with Robert Hunter. I don't know. Don't really care. Let there be songs to fill the air. Let's sing together. We laugh, we cry.